So my topic today is structural injustice. I'm not going to say much, anything about injustice, but I'm going to try and say a few things about structure. If you share any of the same friends on Facebook as me, you will feel as if structural injustice is not just pervasive in the real world, but pervasive in the intellectual world as well. I can't turn left or right without someone telling me there is some structural injustice causing some practice or some relationship or some institutional setting. This is some way of direction. So what I want to do in this talk is try and pin down what might be meant by describing an injustice as structural, and most importantly, what kind of injustices, if any, are appropriately designated as such. So to begin with an example, it's very common to hear practices like capitalist exploitation, patriarchal objectification, racist segregation described not just as unjust, but as structurally unjust. The notion of systemic or structural racism in particular has an increasing currency. To cite just one example of this, social commentators write, and I quote, that systematic racism is built right into every level of our society. Many people point to what they see as less in-your-face prejudice and bias these days. Yet racism itself persists in our schools, offices, court system, police departments, and elsewhere. Structural racism is embedded in the very structure of society. Now, I would ask you to guess who said that, but you've all seen the slide, and that, of course, is Ben and Jerry that say that. Not a joke. That actually is from the Ben and Jerry website. They have three comment pieces on systemic racism. That's drawn from two of those, including their glossary on racial injustice. That gives us a hint of how prevalent these ideas might be, but maybe isn't the most philosophically advanced discussion. A better discussion might be found in, for example, Iris Marion Young, her book Justice and Politics of Difference, where she gives what in many ways is a sort of canonical account of structural injustice. So she says, oppression refers to systematic constraints on groups, not necessarily the result of the intentions of a tyrant. Oppression is structural rather than the result of a few people's choices. Its causes are embedded in unquestioned norms, habits, and symbols, and the collective consequences of following these rules and norms. In this extended structural sense, oppression refers to vast, deep injustices, which some groups suffer as a consequence of often unconscious assumptions and reactions of well-meaning people in ordinary interactions, in short, in the normal processes of everyday life. These injustices are systematically reproduced in major economic, political, and cultural institutions. The actions of many individuals daily contribute to maintaining and reproducing this oppression. Okay, so that gives us a sense of some of the themes that we might want to look for in a case, an instance of structural oppression. So let's put those into three. These are by no means a definition, these are just descriptions, features that structural injustice might display, greater or lesser degree. It might be the product of unintentional actions, the product of actions, practices that are so embedded in social life that they become everyday, they become normalised. Connected to that, they might be entirely unremarkable, the practices and actions that contribute to them. And as a result, the resulting injustice might be opaque, hard to recognise, hard to notice. And thirdly, we might think that the source of these injustices is in some way anonymous, by which I mean it cannot be attributed or assigned to one specific agent or set of coordinating agents, but rather as a cumulative or aggregative effect of the actions of many uncoordinated, unincorporated agents. So this is our target. Can we first of all, flesh out an account of the kinds of injustices that may or may not meet these criteria? Which injustices, if any, match on to this? Now, it's quite common, certainly in the Marxist tradition, to claim that capitalist modes of production are just unambiguously forms of structural injustice or structural bad or structural wrong. And one of the arguments that's often put forward for that is the claim that workers are coerced by structures to engage in certain practices like wage labour, which may or may not be more or less demeaning, degrading, impoverishing. And it's those structural relations and practices that coerce or force those workers into those practices. That's an argument that we see made very recently by Alan Wood and Jeffrey Ryman, that coercion can be structural. I think that's entirely wrong. I'm going to try and argue against that view. Coercion is not, in any thick, meaningful, or irreducible sense, a structural injustice. Maybe unjust in other ways, but it's not a structural injustice. Another common claim that's made is made by Republicans like Philip Pettit, Frank Lovett in particular, who argue that domination is a grave, perhaps the most grave injustice, and that it cannot be in any irreducible way structural. It must always be something else called interpersonal or interactional. Domination is never structural for the Republicans. I'm going to argue against that. I'm going to say that domination is meaningfully and importantly described as structural, meets some of these features. I'm going to try and provide an account of domination that allows us to say that contra the Republicans. Okay, so what we need to do, first of all, before we start talking about these injustices, is get a handle on what we might mean by structure, structures, and structural. So what is it that makes a social structure? Number of candidate definitions available here. There are very minimalist accounts which claim it's anything that's the product of human or artificial action is a social structure. But that looks like just a non-starter. That's going to be far too capacious for our purposes. A narrower definition would say that structures are stable products of patterned actions, stable over time. That seems a bit better, but there's a lot of things that we might not want to describe as structures that would nonetheless fit this bill. What if, for example, the stability is haphazard or accidental and is fragile? This set of practices or relations, these behaviours, just happen to be stable. We might want a more robust notion of structure. So I'm going to follow roughly the account that's given by Anthony Giddens and William Sewell and endorsed by Sally Haslinger, which amounts to something like this, that structures are reproduced and reproducing products of action which is patterned by internalised and external factors. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, internalised factors might include things like what Giddens calls rules, what Sewell calls schemas. These might be dispositions, attitudes, social norms, which guide and direct actions in social life. The external factors include what Giddens and Sewell and Haslinger all call resources, which might include tangible material resources, but it might include other things like social status or physical strength. I'm not going to say much more about that stuff. I think that's reasonably uncontroversial in literature. What's more interesting is this first claim, that structures are reproduced and reproducing. That's often neglected when people gloss the Giddens-Sewell stuff. They focus on this rules and resources or schemas and resources stuff. But I think it's really the reproduction, the self-reproduction feature that's most important. So here's my definition of structure. I'm not going to argue for this. And it's somewhat different from the Giddens-Sewell-Haslinger account, insofar as it's better. So here it goes. So structures are relatively regularized patterns of social interaction set within relatively stabilized patterns of social relations, where those relations are composed of positions, i.e. nodes, locations in this network of relations. There are pathways between these nodes, and there are norms or schemas, dispositions that may be internalized or apply pressure to agents, depending on which position they occupy, which pathways they explore. The interactions in A proceed from the positions along the pathways according to the norms in this network of relations in C. And then we get to the reproduction bit. The pattern of relations in B and C tend to systematically reproduce and tend to be systematically reproduced by the patterns of interaction in A and D. So basically, when I talk about social structures here, what I mean is anything which has something like these things, patterns of interaction, patterns of relations, composed of positions, pathways and norms, that has this functional output. It tends to, has a strong tendency to reproduce itself over time. And that self-reproduction is a product of the interplay between the actions that take place within these relations and the relations that prompt these actions. We might question what things, if any, meet this definition. But insofar as anything does, then I'm going to consider it a social structure. And I think various injustices, foremost among them domination, fit something like this pattern. But other injustices, like coercion, do not. They might play a role in this story, but they're not. They should not be identified with this kind of entity. Okay, I'm going to take as a kind of focal point throughout this discussion, as a paradigmatic statement of some of the things I'm concerned about, the following statement by Martin Luther King Jr., where King wrote, "One of the great problems that the Negro confronts is his lack of power. The plantation and the ghetto were created by those who had power, both to confine those who had no power and to perpetuate their powerlessness." I think this is very suggestive. I don't think it wears its meaning on its sleeve, but I think it's very suggestive. I think there are elements both of a coercion-based critique of racial structures and elements of a domination-based critique. And I think the mistake that Marxists have made is they've overblown the coercion-based critique, conflated it with the domination critique to claim mistakenly that coercion can be structural. And I think the Republicans have made, in some ways, the reverse error. They've identified the domination-based elements of this critique with the coercion-based elements. They've claimed quite rightly that coercion cannot be structural, but have claimed, inferred from that quite mistakenly, that domination cannot be structural either. I'm going to try and unsettle both those claims. Okay, so what do we mean by coercion? I'm going to say the least about coercion because I think it's not as interesting as domination. I think it's easier to dismiss this faulty Marxist argument about coercion. So we just schematically say that coercion must exhibit this kind of structure. A, by doing omega, coerces B into doing phi. And what do we mean by that? How do we unpack that? There are lots of ways that A's might get B's to do phi's. They might manipulate them, they might bribe them, they might induce them to do it. Coercion is a very particular, specific way that one agent gets another agent to do something. So we need to ask what we mean by omega here. So some possibilities. One might be that A coerces B into doing phi by raising the benefits of phi. But that looks entirely mistaken as a kind of coercion because that looks like an offer, and we typically distinguish offers from threats and identify coercion with threats, not with offers. I think the story's more complicated than that about the relationship between offers, threats and coercion. I'm just going to run with that for the time being. So we might propose instead that coercion involves something like raising the cost of not filing. So A might issue some charge that's attached to B not fine. It looks like Frank Lovett, one of the chief Republicans, that wants to define coercion this way. To coerce someone, Lovett writes, is to change what he or she would otherwise prefer to do by raising the costs associated with one or more of his or her options. Again, I think this is a bad account of coercion. So Harry Frankfurt has a neat argument against this, where he says, the butcher raises the price of meat. That might well change your preferences about whether or not to buy that meat. Maybe in some cases, you know, price gouging, maybe that might be coercive, but not all cases of raising market prices are instances of price gouging. So not all cases of raising the costs on some action are instances of coercion. We need something stronger than that. And so I'm just going to go with, it's still quite vague, but it's specific enough for our purposes. Define the relevant coercive action as follows. For A to coerce B into doing Phi, A must impose serious or unreasonable costs on B's not Phi. There are still arguments to be had about that, but we don't need to get into that for my purposes today. This gives us a rough framework through which we could analyse coercion. We might say that there are two general features that coercion must exhibit. Must be asymmetric, one agent must have power over another, and that power must involve unfreedom. A has the ability, the power, to render B unfree. This will be relevant when we come to talk about domination in a moment. And if we go back to our paradigmatic statement from King, we can see these elements of coercion, I think, fairly clearly, when he talks about the plantation and the ghettos being created by those with power to confine those who have no power. Maybe we want to make it even weaker clear. This isn't even coercion, this is just negative unfreedom, it's just prevention. It's not raising costs, imposing threats, it's just raising barriers, value tackles. Okay, that gives us a sense of what coercion might be. Let's see what domination might be. The leading contemporary account of domination is offered by the Republicans, chiefly among them Philip Pettit, who defines it as domination as follows. Someone dominates or subjugates another to the extent that, one, they have the capacity to interfere, two, with impunity and at will, three, in certain choices, that the other is in a position to make. This might, I presume this is going to be familiar to many of you. This is one of Pettit's early formulations. In his later writings, he changes component two to B, the capacity to interfere on an arbitrary basis. But I'm just going to take with impunity and at will to be equivalent to on an arbitrary basis. Talk a bit more about what that involves. There are four senses in which a dominated agent might escape this arbitrary power, might escape domination. Two general strategies. We might, in order to overturn domination, constrain the dominated agent, limit their power. Or we might focus on the dominated agent and empower them, inflate or amplify their powers. Two strategies under each. We might, first of all, just impose formal constraints on the dominator. Well, this is the quote Lovett. Effective rules, procedures or goals that constrain the modes of interference that A can impose on B. We might go further, though, and Pettit wants to go further, and we might constrain A in some more substantive rather than procedural way. Pettit describes this as the constraints having a character such that A is forced to track the avowable common interests of B. And this seems at least like a somewhat plausible move, given that by Lovett's own admission, number one, formal constraint is compatible with rigorously legal discrimination. So on Lovett's account, we can have non-domination in a discriminatory, apartheid-based society, provided this very minimal formal criterion is met. And if, like me, you think it's absurd to think that rigorously legal apartheid is not dominating, then you're going to want something else. Pettit gives us something else by appealing to substantive constraints. I think that's inadequate, but at least overcomes the very fundamental problem that it's confronted by. Those are the two most common strategies that most Republicans and commentators on Republicanism focus on, but there are two other features that have come out much more in Pettit's more recent writings, like On the People's Terms. And these shift the focus away from constraining the dominator towards empowering the dominatee. Again, we might distinguish two types. We might formally empower B, so give B a certain form of social status that allows B to look her fellow citizens in the eye. And insofar as she has that status, that social standing, regardless of what other differences there may be, differences in terms of race, gender, class, wealth and so on, as long as those formal status-based elements are met, as long as the eyeball test is met, then B is not dominated. But we might want to go further still and say that's not going to be enough, because even though the eyeball test is met, this formal empowerment is achieved, there might still be underlying, opaque, more insidious forms of power asymmetry, which constitute domination. So we might need to do more, we might need to substantively empower B. And Pettit seems to suggest something like this when he talks about ensuring that agents stand ready to resist interference. So he talks about citizens being ready to resist their government. That's necessary in order for the government to avoid being a source of domination. I'm going to return to all of this because I think this is woefully inadequate for diagnosing cases of domination. I think each of these conditions can be met, but domination can nonetheless persist. How does this all work? Let's imagine we have a space traveller, travels by his own, himself, let's call him Solo. Let's imagine he crash lands in a planet filled by giant creatures, let's call them Kashikians. They have immense power over Solo. They could rip his arms out. But they have a benevolent disposition towards Solo. They like him. Why do they like him? He's a rogue. But he's a lovable rogue. So they don't actively interfere with him. But they have the power to interfere. They could interfere at will and with impunity. There is nothing that Solo could do to resist their interference. That looks like a paradigmatic case of republican domination. And let's contrast it with a paradigmatic case of republican non-domination. Let's imagine Solo doesn't crash land on Kashyyyk. Let's imagine he crash lands on the forest moon of Endor and is surrounded by many small Endorians. But their powers are so puny compared to Solo's. Solo can so readily and easily resist their attempts at interference that there's no sense in which Solo is dominated by them. He has the requisite empowerment. Their powers are suitably constrained. Solo avoids republican domination. This can help us chart one of the major differences between coercion on the one hand and domination on the other. Coercion, as we said, involves asymmetry. A has power over B. That asymmetry isn't just of any kind. It must involve a power to interfere or reduce the freedom of B. To that degree, coercion and domination are more or less
as one.
He's on the same page. But domination has this further element, what I'm going to call entrenchment. I'm going to flesh out more what I mean by entrenchment as we go, and this is going to be crucial for my argument that coercion is not and cannot be structural, but domination can. So I don't know if any of you have read any of the Patrick O'Brien books or seen the Russell Crowe Paul Bettany movie. There's a passage in one of the books, I tried to find it, but I couldn't find it, one of the later books, where Maturin, who's a physician, is sailing with his very close friend, Aubrey, who's the captain of HMS Surprise. And they've had, as they often do, a falling out. They're very fast friends, but they have big personalities. They often clash. And Maturin, the physician, is desperate to try and get Aubrey to talk about this awkward matter. Can't remember what it was. Let's imagine it was something about money. And after dinner one night, just the two of them are in the captain's cabin, and Maturin says to Aubrey, "Drop your trousers, please." And Aubrey does, because this is his physician. Maturin begins to examine Aubrey's prostate. And Patrick O'Brien, the novelist, in this beautiful phrase says, "From this position of unassailable moral advantage, Maturin asked the question." That's something of what I mean by entrenchment here. Unassailable moral advantage. Okay, so let's flesh out what this might mean in more detail. Here's one initial distinction we should make between coercion and domination. Coercion is punctual, domination is durative. So coercion is like other transitive and intransitive verbs, like set, catch, punish, interfere. Whereas domination is durative, it's akin to walk, play, fight, praise. I don't want to place too much weight on ordinary language use here. I think the usage can be too fuzzy, but I think it's at least suggestive. It can point us in the right direction. Certain typical usage helps us capture something of the distinction between coercion and domination. It might not be exact in all cases, but I think it gets us in the right direction. This should lead us to make two distinctions between coercion and domination. First, in terms of modality, coercive interference must be actual, not merely possible. Vulnerability to coercive interference is not coercion. To be vulnerable to coercion is not to be coerced. However, dominating interference need only be possible, not actual. To be vulnerable to dominating interference is to be dominated. It's to be in this entrenched position of asymmetric unfreedom. And the second distinction that follows from the first: coercion obtains only in the moment of actualized interference. There's a moment before coercion, before the threat is issued. There's a moment of coercion when the threat is issued and acted upon. And then a moment after coercion has taken place. The coercion itself is just in that one single moment. We can't divide that moment into socially salient, socially relevant partitions. But with domination, it's different. Domination obtains both in the moment of vulnerability, in which interference is possible, and also in the moment of interference, in which vulnerability may be exploited, interference may be actualized or not. So that's a sense in which domination, I think, is durative in a way that coercion is not. And that's the sense in which I intend to describe domination as entrenched in a way that coercion is not. I don't think anything I've said about domination there is controversial to a Republican. I think they should all accept that. Philip doesn't entirely agree with me, but he's simply wrong. I don't think I've said anything a Republican need object to. But I think Republicans don't fully appreciate the implications of these conclusions, and it's the one implication of these conclusions is that domination can meaningfully be structured, and correlatively, coercion cannot be meaningfully structured. Okay, for structural coercion, here's the Marxist argument that I'm going to argue against. I think it's a mistake, and it claims that coercion can be structural. I think that's far. So Alan Wood says you can be coerced to do something without there being anyone who coerces you. Cases of coercion without a coercer. You can be coerced by circumstances for which no single person or persons is or are responsible. Similarly, Jeffrey Ryman: structural coercion makes non-owners self-owners, so proletarians, self-capitalists. The structure of ownership itself forces this service. It's not agents that force the service. It's the structure that forces. The whole society does the forcing. Okay, I think I can see why there might be some intuitive appeal to this, but I think it just fundamentally misunderstands the grammar of coercion. And as a result, whilst Wood and Ryman might be well-meaning, they want to say, look, there's much more unfreedom in the world than we give credit for, because these voluntary market transactions between proletarians and capitalists are actually coerced. I think that's well-intentioned, but mistaken. I think there is unfreedom in those relationships, but the unfreedom is domination, not coercion. Okay, so how does coercion fit this bill, these earlier features of structural injustice? Well, I mean, it might be kind of unintentional if the whole society is forcing non-owners to serve owners. They might not be doing this consciously. It might well be opaque. I mean, that's the whole point of Marxian critique of capitalism, is to say seemingly voluntary interactions in labour markets are actually not so free. And it might be anonymous in some way. You know, the proletarian is dependent on the capitalist class, but not dependent on any particular capitalist. So maybe there's some way we could describe coercion as structural here. But I think it's just mistaken. For various reasons. I'll just focus on one. So we put claims about coercion into the passive voice. Say, B is coerced into doing as he wants by A, leaving B with no reasonable alternative. Then doesn't seem anything too weird about saying we could change the identity of the coercer or the beneficiary, and it would still be coercion if B is left with no reasonable alternative by the action of some agent. Then that's coercive. Yeah, I'm happy to accept that. But this is the move that these Marxists make. They move to this claim. B is forced into doing as he wants by circumstances which leave B with no reasonable alternative. And that might seem like it's an innocuous move. What's really important here is both Ryman and Wood, they both move from the language of coercion to the language of force or compulsion. And those are seriously different things. I mean, it might be plausible to say it was so cold outside I was forced to buy this expensive coat in the shop. Does it seem, at least not to me, implausible to say that non-agential forces, inanimate forces, natural forces, circumstances might force us to do things? But to be forced to do something is very different from being coerced to do something. Because coercion involves the issuing of threat. And circumstances can't do that. I mean, Wood kind of acknowledges this. He says, yeah, I'm going to use coercion in this broader, more expansive sense, but I just don't see the benefits of doing that. I think we just end up misdiagnosing what we're trying to get at. And a further feature of this is, I think it makes the Marxists, these Marxists at least, miss out on really interesting further claims they could make, is they just stop here. But we could look at further features like B being forced by circumstances where A or A's are able at no unreasonable cost to alleviate these circumstances. That wouldn't be coercion because A's aren't issuing threats. But through their inaction, we might say that they are contributing to unfreedom. But that's different from coercion. It's importantly different from coercion. Maybe it's worse than coercion, but it's not the same as coercion. And we could go even further and say, what about cases in which B is forced by circumstances to do as A wants, and where A's could become able to alleviate these circumstances at no unreasonable cost, but willfully choose not to develop those capacities? I think this is a grave form of injustice, and I think it's all too commonly practiced. I think pretty much all Western societies engage in exactly this mode of injustice, when they fail to develop the capacities that would allow them to, for example, alleviate gross global inequalities. But they say, there's nothing we can do, our hands are tied. That might be true that there's nothing they could do right now, but they could, at no unreasonable cost, develop the capacity to alleviate those circumstances. I think Cecilia Ward, in her work on global justice, she points towards something like this. I think the Marxists are just missing a trick here by stopping at three. Not moving to five. So that's why coercion can't be structural. Okay, in 7 minutes, I'll tell you why domination can be. Okay, two important implications of the Republican view: domination is necessarily personal and necessarily not impersonal. I won't bother reading this, it's fairly obvious that the Republicans think because domination is a power of interference and only agents can wield these powers, therefore only agents can be dominators. Interestingly, they say that domination can't be structural in any irreducible way. The dominator must always be an agent. Domination is always a relationship between persons, not possible for structures as such to dominate. But they then go on, especially in the more recent writings, to say domination could be structural in some reducible or instrumental way when the structure indirectly facilitates the arbitrary power of a dominator. Pettit's happy to acknowledge that. Interestingly, some Republicans want to push this line and say domination can be more structural. But even the people like Cecilia Ward, Miriam Ronzoni, Alex Gurevich, who want to really argue that Republican domination can be structural, they don't get any further than structural in this reducible sense. Domination, structures facilitate or enable or legitimise interpersonal domination. It's still agents that dominate agents, it's just that structures allow dominating agents to dominate. Structures themselves don't dominate. So as Laborde says, domination is structural, but is ultimately operated by agents. Domination is both agential and structural, Laborde and Ronzoni say. Well, only agents can probably be said to dominate. These are the strongest defenders of structural domination, and they just keep pulling their punches. And I think they're right to do so, insofar as those conclusions are necessary if one is committed to the Republican paradigm. So why be committed to the Republican paradigm? If domination is only a power of interference, then yes, it can only be wielded by agents. So the question for us, is domination only a power of interference? It is at least that, but it might be more than that. I want to argue also involves practices or processes of disempowerment, which can be and should be decoupled from the wielding of power. So the dominating agent wields a certain power, the dominated agent is subject to certain disempowering forces, and those two things can come apart, and when they come apart sufficiently far, that's where we have cases of structural domination. And I think that's what King's going for when he talks about not just the lack of power that Negroes experience, but the perpetuation of this powerlessness. That process, the perpetuation of powerlessness, need not be a function of, a reflection of, or a product of the arbitrary power held by some agent or agents. So let's go back to Solon on Endor. He's stronger than all these Endorians individually, and they try and, you know, give him a bum deal, or offer him a degrading, demeaning contract, or offer him a marriage proposal that he doesn't find appealing, or offer him a housing in a ghetto that he doesn't like. And he's more powerful than all of them. He can resist all of them, but they just keep on interfering. They don't coordinate their actions. Maybe they're not even aware that each of the other Endorians is engaging in this practice. They don't incorporate to form a group agent. At regular intervals, let's say on a daily basis, if Solo can resist between 100 and 200 Endorians, it fluctuates on a daily basis, but at least 200 Endorians interfere each day. So every day there will come a point where Solo is no longer able to resist interference by some one Endorian. On Monday, maybe it's Bob Endorian. On Tuesday, it's Timmy Endorian. Let's ask ourselves the Castilian question. If domination is a power of arbitrary interference, and all these Endorians have exactly the same power, and most of them will never successfully interfere with Solo, then where's the domination? Where's the arbitrary power? Look and see. There's no arbitrary power there. Let's test this. And a sable moral advantage. Okay, there's lots of ways we might apply this, but I don't have time, so I'm not going to do that. Sorry for missing it. Let's go back to these four criteria for Republican non-domination. The Endorians need to be formally constrained by effective rules. Sure, they are. Endorians can only interfere once a day. Solo is empowered to resist their interference, repel their, refuse their offer. Tick. The Endorians must be substantively constrained, forced to track Solo's avowable common interests. Sure, maybe they are. Maybe marriage is a good thing. And so marriage offers are permissible. Maybe giving someone housing is a good thing. So offering someone housing in a ghetto is permissible. Maybe employment is a good thing. So offering someone a labour contract is permissible. And maybe these things are permissible by Solo's own lights. Maybe Solo's formally empowered, he can pass the eyeball test. Well, of course he can. On a daily basis, he defeats at least 99, maybe as many as 200 of these, and Doran's even massively more powerful than any of them individually. He looks each of them in the eye every day. He's probably going to defeat each of these Endorians many more times than any one of them will defeat him. So he passes the eyeball test. Solo's substantively empowered, he stands ready to resist. Well, of course he does, we've just said. He resists at least 99, perhaps as many as 200 of these Endorians each day. But that's the problem with interpersonal models of domination. You need only be ready to resist some one person. It doesn't talk about the wider social structural processes that might lead to disempowerment. A single instance of catcalling in the street might be tiresome, but constant catcalling is exhausting. Being asked once, as a former partner of mine used to be asked frequently, yeah, sure, you were born in London, but where are you really from? Which is my craze. That might be tiresome, that one question, but when that question gets asked to you every day, it's exhausting. But yet, we might not want to ban or prohibit those interactions because they might track common interests, they facilitate forms of social intercourse. But nonetheless, they result in systematic disempowerment of certain agents. How much time do I get?
5 minutes, 10 minutes.
Okay. Solo stands ready to resist. Sure he does. Gets offered a labour contract by Warren, the philanthropic Endorian. Gets offered another contract by Donald, the lecherous Endorian. He doesn't have to accept either of them because he could accept the offer from Bob or from Timothy, from any of the other Endorians. Maybe on Monday he accepts Warren's offer, refuses Donald's. Maybe on Tuesday he accepts Donald's offer, refuses Warren's. Stands ready to resist each of these offers, but nonetheless Solo must accept some one of these offers because his powers will be worn down. Maybe the Republicans might say, okay, look, doesn't matter, it's going to vary which of these Endorians can interfere, but whichever Endorian does successfully interfere, they have arbitrary power. So what my account of disempowerment is doing is helping us identify when certain agents have arbitrary power. You might say, okay, look, the archetypical master can interfere however and whenever she likes. The successful Endorian can interfere however she likes, only when certain conditions are met. And those conditions are these processes of disempowerment. Okay, so what are the conditions? Well, the successful Endorian can interfere whenever all these many other Endorians interfere first. Somewhere between 100 and 200 other Endorians. But that's not enough, because what if Solo is disempowered by these 200 Endorians, Warren goes to interfere, but Donald nips in there first? It must be necessary for the successful interferer to interfere immediately after these other Endorians have interfered, in order to occupy that position of dominance. Then we need to ask, well, how do we know how many Endorians need to interfere? We've said it's going to vary, it's going to fluctuate from day to day, whether it's 100 or 200 Endorians that produce this disempowerment, this impairment of Solo's power to resist. So now the Republican has to say, okay, the successful interferer has arbitrary power because she can interfere whenever A1 to N interfere first, where AN is at least the 100th and most the 200th interferer, and provided the next Endorian interferes immediately thereafter. But again, we just said this fluctuates between 100 and 200. How do we know precisely when LP, the successful, it should be AP, the successful interferer interferes? Finally, the Republicans say, okay, look, the Endorian has arbitrary power when she can interfere whenever A1 to AN interfere first, where the interference of A1 to AN appears to Oliver, and provided that AP interferes immediately thereafter. That's the only place Republicans can go. And what's that place? My place. Because they're defining arbitrary power in terms of the impairment of the dominatee's powers. There's no way to identify this dominator with reference to the dominator's supposedly arbitrary power, it's the systematic disempowerment of the dominatee that explains when and how domination occurs. This, if Republicans are, you know, half the move from their archetypical account of domination to this seemingly more nuanced account, they've emptied arbitrary power of all meaning, all distinct meaning, and they're understanding arbitrary power in terms of my preferred notion, systematic disempowerment or impairment. Okay, so now I'll begin my critique of republicanism. Not going to have time for that. Basically, what we can say is there are various kinds of powers agents. This is what I'm doing. Various kinds of powers that agents might possess. So dominators might possess the power of arbitrary interference. That means, that implies that B lacks a reliable power of resistance. Again, those are just equivalent claims. The Republicans should dispute that. This allows for three vectors of change or dynamism, whether B can or will attempt to find, whether A can or will interfere with B's attempt at find, and whether B can or will attempt to resist A's interference with B's attempt at find. Pretty clear stuff. The Republicans can acknowledge all those vectors of change, all those dynamic processes, but they can't acknowledge this dynamic process, whether B can or will attempt to develop or maintain the power to resist. Arbitrary power, the Republican paradigm, can only speak to 1 to 3. It's insufficiently dynamic to speak to these processes, the development and maintenance of power. That's why we need to move to a model of domination as disempowerment. And there's a number of things we could do here about how the philosophy of language might help us here. So the Republicans talk about domination as purely as a stative. It's something he has, holds, enjoys, or wields. And that might be right in one sense. Domination is at least partly stative, but it's not wholly stative. Because, for example, it can occur in the progressive, whereas statives cannot. It can also appear as an imperative, dominate, disempower are imperatives, but possess, wield, at least in typical usage or not, maybe some atypical usage in which you might instruct someone to wield. If you're Odin instructing Thor to wield Mjolnir, that might work. Let's call that an atypical use. Let me just skip forward. This is all just So this is my definition of domination. You need an agent with some power to interfere, but that agent's power to interfere might not be so great as to be arbitrary, so long as there's systematic disempowerment, systematic impairment of the resistance of the dominatee. And then from this, we can just plug in different models of domination. So we might have just direct interactional domination. Some agent has a power to interfere because that very agent produces the vulnerability of the dominatee. So the slave master who prevents the slave from learning to read is producing the slave's disempowerment and thereby empowering herself, the master. That captures, I think, everything that the Republican wants to capture in their model of arbitrary power. But what the Republican struggles to deal with are maybe more indirect forms, when A1 has the power to interfere, but it's A2 that has produced this vulnerability. The Republican could probably capture that. They would say, you know, things like the patriarchal husband who's benevolent has the power to arbitrarily interfere, even though it's some legal system that produces the vulnerability. So a Republican has to accept this indirect model. Now I want to say, well, if we accept that when A1 produces and exploits B's impairment, that that's domination, and if we accept that when A produces and some other A2 exploits the impairment, that's domination, the Republican has to accept that. What if A1 and A2 incorporate to form a group agent who impairs? The Republican has to accept that. What if they don't incorporate but coordinate to produce impairment? Well, if the impairment's there, then that still looks like it's going to be domination, like so. What if they don't coordinate at all? What if it's the cumulative result of their uncoordinated action that results in systematic disempowerment? That's what happens to Solo on Endor. You know, as these faces these multiple foes, can defeat many of them, but is always, regularly, systematically disempowered. He will always be vulnerable to some one Endorian, but we can't say in advance which one is. And none of them hold arbitrary power because they're not coordinated to produce that. They're not intentionally coordinated to produce that disempowerment. And that gives us this structural domination. For each salient time slice, some party possesses a power to interfere with me. And as an aggregate effect of the individual uncoordinated but structurally mandated actions of several agents, there's impairment of B's power to resist through the workings of this social structure. That's how domination can be structural. That's what the Republicans miss, because they fail to decouple disempowerment from arbitrary interference. As soon as we make that decoupling, then we can recognise these cases of the proletarian, the woman in a patriarchal society who isn't married to some abusive husband, the African American in some racist society, who might not be enslaved, might not have to live in some ghetto, but must live in one ghetto. The proletarian who doesn't need to work for any one particular capitalist, but must work for some capitalist because of the workings, the aggregate effects of these social structures. That's domination, it's not coercion. That's how domination is structural, and relatively why coercion is not. Thank you.